Hello, everybody. I'm very, very delighted to be with you tonight. And in this new reality, it's always a new reality. And over the next 6 weeks, as we invoke and experience and above all, sense our connections to Goddess, the subtle power whose life is the life of this universe. This series is based on a radical premise which many of you know very well. It's based on what is known in India as the Shakta Tantric view of reality. That is the recognition that every particle and the creative power behind and within all life is feminine, is Shakti, is literally, Shakti literally means power, whereas the silent, transcendent, vast stillness of the source of everything is understood as masculine. And in the tradition that I teach from, the masculine source is called Shiva, that which underlies, and the feminine power of becoming is called Shakti. One contemporary philosopher calls these two aspects of reality being and becoming. So in our human experience, this being aspect of reality is felt as our pure sense of existence, of being. That sense of, it's almost no words for it, that sense of being yourself that is has been present ever since we came into the world. And it's also accessible to us as this subtle awareness that deep meditation reveals to us. And the becoming aspect, the Shakti aspect, is everything else. Our thoughts, our bodies, our emotions, the situation on the teleclass, our ideas, the physical world, the subtle world, the internet world. It's all, these are all aspects of becoming. They're all aspects of the Shakti. So when everybody's data disappears off of our webpage, that is the primordial Shakti acting through the web. And these two aspects of reality are engaged in an eternal dance, which in a very interesting way, the evolutionary biologists of, or many evolutionary biologists in our day, hold to a theory that the universe, the physical universe, is self-organizing. In other words, that the power within life causes these tiny, tiny subatomic particles called quarks to join together with others, to become basins, to become atoms, to become molecules, to become cells, and so on through the evolutionary chain that certainly includes us and probably life forms that are beyond ours. But what the sages of Tantra tell us, and what this teaching is based on, is this understanding that all of this expresses itself as a transformation of the world, flashes and pulses in the heart of reality, expressing itself as subtle powers to will, to intend, to understand, and to act. And Tantra holds that all of the vastness and power of the source, of the Shakti at our source, of the deep stillness at our source, can be experienced through our human organism if we have the will to search and the grace to realize it. And Tantra also holds that we, its children, have a very hard time seeing what we are, because there's an intrinsic quality in reality that in the Tantric text, in the text of India, is called Maya, which is the power of concealment that obscures and separates us from realizing this truth. So Maya is like a prism that literally splits the oneness so that we experience ourselves as separation. And this teaching that we're going to be working with, this recognition that we're going to be working with, is at the heart of all the non-dual traditions of the East and many of the mystical traditions of the West. This idea that our true nature is one all-encompassing suchness, which we are not able to see because of this veiling. And in the Shakta traditions, we follow the path of acting as if we could see through the curtain and simply regarding everything we experience as a play of sacred energies, as forms of goddess. And the idea is that when we study and contemplate and meditate from this viewpoint, this fundamentally non-dual viewpoint, we eventually come to see through the surface of the world and start to realize the mysterious flow of which we are a part and which actually flows from our own heart. So my intention and my hope is that by looking into and practicing with some of the faces of Goddess, some of the faces of embodied Shakti, especially the goddess forms that have come to us through the Indian tradition, but also with some of the Western traditions, will deepen our relationship with our own divine creative powers. So before we begin, I want to say something, first of all, about the way this course is structured, and just something about why practicing with goddess technology is such a profound way of shifting our vision. One of the, this course is, it's part of a spectrum of feminine-focused teachings. We're unfolding and discovering a worldview that places the feminine at the center of our spiritual life, not in order to deny masculine spirit or what is often called masculine spirit, but to unveil an aspect of spirit that was, it is no longer, hidden from public view for thousands of years. Obviously, modern goddess practice is necessarily entwined with modern feminism. My intuition is that modern feminism was one of the early signs that goddess is once again taking her place, taking her space. But goddess feminism it's really not just for women. Goddess feminism, spiritual feminism, is really about recognizing sacred presence in every human, in every living thing, and also in the physical world, because one of the core recognitions of goddess practice is a deep, deep connection to the physical world as the form of the sacred. So goddess feminism is really about making what's sometimes called the sacred marriage, the evolutionary marriage between two forms of life that always existed, but which somehow seem to have become separated, and that is the marriage between being and becoming, between awareness and joy, between nature and spirit. So the sort of special quality of goddess practice is that it deepens our relationship with our own creative powers, our own sacred powers. And that, again, this is one of the hallmarks of Tantra, one of the hallmarks of Shakta Tantra, is that through a series of practices, including the practices of mantra, the practices of visualizing deity forms, and the practices of seeing into the workings of our own body and breath as powers of the sacred, we begin to be able to recognize how powerfully we hold sacred energies. And just to take a moment of, let's say, historical consciousness, I want to point out that goddess practice is one of the oldest religions in the world. Evidence of it appears in archaeological sites in France and Turkey and Crete, and essentially in all the societies in which humans observed the flow of seasons, the movement of planets, the cycles of germination, growth, maturity, and death that occurred every year in the forests and fields. When I was in Europe in 2014, I was shown a book about the Charvet Caves, which some of you may have seen. And in the Charvet Caves, which are famous for the amazing charcoal drawings of animals and hunters, many of the paintings in it, of the drawings in it, concern the hunt. One of the aspects of those caves that was not ordinarily seen or known was this gigantic drawing of a feminine form which occupies an entire wall of the cave, and that form shows plants, animals, and humans tumbling out of her vulva, tumbling out of her vagina. And this painting is, in the painting, the goddess is naked. She's, it's almost as though she's depicted as the backdrop of life, as the hidden fact of life. And apparently this was how goddess was worshipped, was seen as the mother who gives birth to everything. And around 7,000 years before the Common Era, that original tradition of seeing goddess as the source of life began to change. Warrior societies, according to the archaeological findings, brought masculine deities into the feminine worlds that had preceded them. And what normally happened was that the masculine deities would be, so to speak, married to the goddesses. The goddesses would become consorts. And eventually, in many of these societies, the goddess figures not only became, so to speak, taken down from their places at the high altars, from the public shrines, they also became hidden. And in India, certainly, there are, which is one of the places in which divine feminine practice has survived, there are nonetheless many, many shrines, caves, in caves and in rocks and in various land masses, which are associated with the body, which are associated with the earth. And, you know, they continue to be invoked and worshipped through the social, even though the social structures of these countries were as patriarchal as, the rest of the world at that time. Nonetheless, in Indian culture, in other Eastern cultures, and in many of the tribal cultures of around the world, the goddess traditions recognized the diverse faces of the feminine. So goddesses were often youthful and beautiful, but they were also wizened and crone-like. They were motherly, they were also warriors. There were goddesses who protected children, and there were goddesses who gave victory in battle, and there were goddesses who were kindled erotic sparks in all of us. And we're going to practice with many of these goddesses, certainly with the goddesses who hold some of the core qualities of the sacred feminine, that is, goddesses who are motherly and compassionate, goddesses who are protective and warrior-like, goddesses who incarnate beauty and sexuality, and goddesses who are all about wisdom, transformation, and initiation. So goddess practice is a spiritual technology that has been honed for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years as a way of shifting our vision so that instead of experiencing the world and our own bodies as dense and hard and outside us, we can begin to recognize the profound interconnectivity and oneness between ourselves and each other and the world. So in terms of the way the course is structured, many of you know that the community that forms during a teleclass forms in the connectivity between all of us. And one of the experiences that many of us have in these virtual sanghams, these virtual communities, is that the sacred feminine actually dances through the particles, the electrical impulses of information packets that are flowing between us, and that as we immerse ourselves in this sacred community, we start to feel her presence very much as a space that opens up when we come onto the call and when we listen to the call. We experience it on the webcast, we experience it on the phone, and we experience it in the MP3, which I think is really kind of an extraordinary truth that this particular form of virtual conversation has opened up for all of us. So the classes have three main parts. First, the lectures, which are, of course, interwoven with meditations and in which we will also have opportunities for questions. Secondly, the homework, which you'll receive either the day after the call or sometimes the night of the call. And the homework will include exercises, poems, illustrations, and much more. All this will be available on the class website, where you can also download the audio files of the classes and also investigate some of the bonus materials that we've put up there. Third aspect is the listserv, which is where you have a chance to interact with each other and with me. And as most of you know, if you feel like there's too much communication coming on the listserv, Deb will be happy to put you in the digest version so you'll get fewer emails, but the key ones. So, and the other thing I'd like to recommend as we begin is the possibility of working with a partner. Some of you know how powerful it can be to have a partner to practice with in the time in between the calls, and if you'd like to do that, again, you can write to Deb, and she will set you up with someone who is hopefully in your time zone. We do the partner work on the phone, unless you happen to be partners with someone who's in your neighborhood. And, you know, having a partner is not just a great way to deepen your experience of what you're discovering here, to deepen your experience of satsang. It also creates a lot of oxytocin, you have deep connection. So in this class, we'll be using the terms Shakti and goddess interchangeably, and I just want to say that that in some quarters of the feminist spiritual world, there's begun to be a kind of a tendency to conflate Shakti with female sexual energy, and the idea that goddess practice is for women. And it's definitely true that men and women often approach goddess practice differently. And that much of the literature about goddesses has been composed by men historically, which I believe is one reason why so much goddess literature takes the form of flattering verses about how great she looks, as if the singer were courting a woman who likes to be told how good she looks. And apparently goddess really does like to be told how beautiful she is. She seems to respond to that, as do all living beings. But the truth is that Shakti is beyond gender. I feel like I have to say that, because even though I know you guys are quite sophisticated about gender and that which is beyond gender, it's very easy to conflate Shakti with the female. And because Shakti is beyond gender, though she also manifests as gender differences, she's also male sexual energy and masculine powers. Because in the tradition we're speaking of, remember, Shakti is literally everything in the world of the physical, emotional, and even subtle world. So Shakti is men as well as women. Shakti is what we see, smell, taste, and feel. And at the same time, one thing I've discovered as I've taught goddess courses is that for many people in male bodies, it might feel most comfortable to understand the divine feminine in terms of feminine roles that you're familiar with, such as the mother or the lover. While for a female human, it might seem more, let's say, easier to understand goddesses as aspects of yourself, powers that you can identify with and incarnate. And this is not to say that women don't experience goddess as mother, lover, protector, friend, sister, and that men don't experience goddess as aspects of their own self, because obviously that's something that we all share. However, at the deepest level, for all of us, in whatever body and at whatever place we are in our lives, we want to more and more deeply understand goddess both as an external force whom we can interface with, who can become a friend and protector and guide for us, who also can be seen in the trees, in the flowers, in the buildings, in the sound of the taxis, and in our own bodies, and also as the internal aspects of power, of insight, of wisdom, of love, that are unique to us as individual humans, and that also are shared by all of us. So Goddess takes infinite, unique individual forms, including the personal anthropomorphic faces in which goddesses have been seen, loved, invoked, and worshipped throughout history. But our really deepest intention for each other and for all of us is to begin to recognize Goddess as the sacred life force and to really reframe our life experience in this light, because this is really the most empowering way there is to understand Goddess. And if this happens for you, this class will have succeeded in impacting you at the deepest level. The more we can see how the sacred feminine, Shakti, is always manifesting as your body, as my body, and as everything we experience through our senses, the more the empowerment will become a reality. So right now, let's bring ourselves into resonance with each other and with the breath. Let's be fully present with the breath. Though generally we prefer not to talk in terms of absolutes, the truth is that there is always an absolute connection between breath and Shakti, between breath and Goddess. The breath, the prana Shakti, is the alchemical transformer that carries the subtlest energies of the cosmos into and through the bodies of animals, birds, and fish, into trees, into the earth. Prana flows through this cosmos as breath, carrying with it the chemicals that make life possible. So prana is the atmosphere we live in, as the ocean is the atmosphere of sea creatures and the sky is the abode of birds. And it's not just that when we breathe, we take in particles of every living creature throughout time, which is one of the mind-blowing truths that cosmologists have begun to explain to us. We also take in particles of Goddess, because breath is the energy of the life force itself. So breath is perhaps the closest connection we have to her vitalizing magic. And as you turn your attention to the breath, notice if there's any part of your body that feels constricted or tight or tense, and see if you can make an intention to turn towards that constriction and open into it, allowing yourself to recognize that even tightness, even tension, even contraction is an aspect of Goddess. And as you feel the caress of breath at the inner edges of your nostrils, focus for a few moments on that connection. And see if as the breath deepens, you also can become aware of the parts of your body that move as the breath moves. And with part of your attention on this flow of breath and the movement of the body caused by the flow of breath, begin to notice the sounds, not just the main sounds, the sound of my voice, but the sounds at the edge of your hearing. begin to sense the sensations in your body. I love to feel the sensation of the air against my skin, which where I am was very warm for most of the day, now is turning a little bit chilly as the sun sets, as the sun sinks. And once again, as we were doing at the very beginning, have the intention to recognize that Goddess in the form of Shakti is present everywhere. Goddess is the sensations. She is the sounds. She's the fluids in your mouth. She's the touch of your clothes. And as we invoke her, talk about her, practice with her this evening, and as we discuss her and describe her in the language of myth, please also keep remembering that she's not just an exotic female form. She's also all the energies that are moving in your experience right now, including in your capacity for paying attention. Attention is one of the most powerful aspects of the goddess and one of our biggest superpowers. In the tradition, it's said that Shiva, the divine masculine, manifests inside human experience as awareness, as the pure capacity for being aware that's the basis of all experience. Shakti manifests as the breath. She also manifests as that impulse to direct your attention. So as Shiva, as the divine masculine, is the vastness behind and beyond all this, Shakti manifests at every moment that you bring your attention to something specific. And it's through that attention that Shakti flows inward to explore the inner world, and ultimately to discover her own source as the vast awareness, which we call Shiva, the divine masculine. And that is one definition of the sacred marriage. So with your attention on the breath, we'll chant an invocation to the goddess and then a mantra. So the first one is from a series of manuscripts. It's one of the poems from the Gnostic Gospels of the Nag Hammadi Library, which were discovered some 50 or 60 years ago in a Christian burial site. And these verses date to a time between the 2nd and 4th centuries of the Common Era. It's from a long poem called Thunder Perfect Mind. I'm just going to quote a few verses. Sent from the power, I have come to those who reflect upon me, and I have been found among those who seek me. Look upon me, you who meditate, and you who hear me. Whoever is waiting for me, take me into yourself. Do not drive me out of your eyes or out of your voice or out of your ears. Do not forget who I am. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter and every part of both. I am the barren one who's borne many sons. I am the bride and I am the bridegroom. I am the incomprehensible silence and the memory that will not be forgotten. I'm the voice whose sound is everywhere. For I am knowledge and ignorance. I am modesty and boldness. I am strength and fear. I am shameless. I am ashamed. I am war and I am peace. I am the one they call life. I am the one they call death. I am the joining and the dissolving. I am what lasts and what goes. I am the one going down and the one towards whom they ascend. I am the speech that cannot be heard, and I am the one who cries out. I am cast forth upon the face of the earth. I am called truth. For what is inside you is what is outside you, and the one who forms you on the outside is the one who shaped you within. I like to think of the voice in this poem as the voice of the goddess of the ancient world, the initiating goddess who in the West is called Isis, Artemis, Ishtar, Sophia, Aphrodite, who is still a living goddess in the early Christian world, and who is fully alive today in and through the goddesses of India. The message of the goddess in this verse, in this poem, is the same message that the Shakta texts of India offer us. And I think that's really quite extraordinary. She's telling us always to remember that she's the one who's become all this. So we're going to chant a verse to the goddess Durga, who is the form within which we're going to invoke the personal aspect of the divine feminine today. And many of you know this shloka. It's actually on the handouts that are available on the course website in the class space. But I'm going to say it to you, and I think it's easy enough so that those of you who didn't get a chance to download it will be able to follow. So the mantra goes, Aum Dum Durgaye Namaha. So Aum is the primordial sound, which is both the sound of the vibratory essence that manifests the universe. We could say it's the sound that's prior to the Big Bang and the sound that we have discovered through our contemporary radio telescopes still reverberates throughout the cosmos in the spaces between particles. You can hear it in space as a kind of a... Dum is the seed syllable of the goddess Durga. And as you can perhaps recognize, it also has the quality of the heartbeat. So we could say that Dum is the force of life. It's the pulse, it's the sound of the pulse of life. And Durga, which has several meanings, it means she who is difficult to know. It also means she who is difficult to conquer. And Durga, as we'll be describing and discussing later, is a warrior mother form of goddess, one perhaps the most popular form of goddess in India, and expressed throughout the religious traditions of the ancient world in the form of the strong feminine, the powerful feminine, the protective feminine, the tiger mom of the traditions. So we'll chant the mantra. I will chant, and you can chant with me. We'll chant 9 times. And you can find your posture. Let the breath bring your attention down through the body so that you feel the connection between your sits bones, your buttocks, and the seat, and feel as though you're surrendering into your seat. Even if you're sitting in a car, you can surrender into the seat of the car. And then allow the exhalation to draw your body upwards through the crown. Allow the chest to lift and the shoulder blades to melt along the back, and begin to feel that the head is suspended from the ceiling by an invisible string that pulls your head upward from the crown, from the fontanelle, and naturally allows the chin to tuck slightly. Aum Dum Durgayai Namaha. Aum Dum Durgayai Namaha. Om, we bow to the goddess Durga, invoking her, bringing her forth, asking her to be present within us. Aum Dum Durgayai Namaha. 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 Your awareness is with the breath. And as you allow your attention to flow with the breath, you imagine for a moment that you're inside a deep primeval forest. The trees are very, very old. You're surrounded by vast oaks, the trees that were at the heart of some of the sacred goddess cultures of Europe and that are still present in our culture in California and around the world. And as you look into the space formed between the trunks of the trees, you see a beehive-shaped structure, domed with a small opening, a structure that in many of the ancient cultures is the form that was understood to be a kind of navel of the world, an opening into the depths of the earth, and a place sacred to goddess in her form as the physical universe. And as you look at this structure, you see that it's very old and covered with vines and flowers, and yet you can see the opening in it, and you allow yourself to be drawn into the opening. It's as though you're actually entering into the womb of the goddess, the womb of the earth goddess, who was so often worshipped and invoked in caves. And in this womb of the earth, you realize that you're in a very, very ancient place. You're inside one of those shrines that are still present in Middle America, other parts of Central America, in India, in old Europe. But in this cave, you see, it's long neglected. And as you move through it, as you look into the darkness, you realize that in the center of this earth temple, is a flood of illumination that actually comes from an opening in the top, so that the light of the sun and the light of the moon flow into and illuminate the shrine. And you see, as your eyes become accustomed to the darkness, you see that there's a subtle illumination that seems to come from the walls of the temple or the cave, as though there were fire in the very depths of it. So you sit on the earthen floor, your eyes are closed, and you ask Goddess to be present with you. Ask her to be present in whatever form she chooses, in the form of a living woman whom you feel connected with, in the form of light, or simply in the form of presence. Allow yourself to be present to the Goddess as the life giver, as the life force, as the nurturer, as the mother of the world, as the mother of the animals. Recognize that the Goddess you're tuning into is that very ancient and primordial presence whom the ancients saw as the source of the rhythmic movements of the seasons, as the rhythm of the sun moving across the earth, of the moon waxing and waning, of the beat of your heart, and the flow of your life from birth through childhood, through maturation, through generativity, and ultimately through dissolution. Feeling your deep connection with that Goddess power who lives in the earth, who lives as the earth, ask yourself, how in this time in my life do I know her? How do I feel her in my body, in the life around me? How can I connect my own body, my own blood, my own spirit to this very ancient feminine presence who lives as the earth, who stretches over us as the sky? Breath is moving through your body. You're connecting through the breath to this ancient form of the Earth Goddess, this cosmic feminine presence who takes the form of the biosphere, the intelligent, life-creating energy, not only of this Earth, but of the entire cosmos. Recognize that she has orchestrated all the changes on this planet over billions of years of deep time. She's the source not only of the land masses on the planet, she's orchestrated ages where the earth was covered with volcanoes and the oceans boiled. Eons when the planet was a tropical rainforest where dinosaurs ruled. She manifested ice ages and, of course, the rise of mammals and ultimately Homo sapiens And finally, she is manifesting in and through human beings to create what is now being called the Anthropocene, the eon of humans, when human actions and human civilizations are interacting with the earth, the terrain, the weather, the atmosphere, to create a new reality on this planet, which is also her. Because there is no separation, whatever we do is done by her. All this is powered by the goddess. All this is powered by the Prana Shakti. So just let yourself, even for a moment, be present to her presence. And recognize that your acts of individual will, your capacity for thinking and discriminating, the affection that you feel, and the emotions that aren't so pleasant, are also all aspects of her. And at the same time, while opening yourself to this truly non-dual recognition of goddess, also realize that she is there for us to take refuge in as a protector, as an inspirer, as a personal form with whom we can interface and interact, and with whom we can fall in love. Not only fall in love, we can get mad at her, we can argue with her, we can beg her for help, we can ask her to show us herself, we can tune into her through our breath, through the forms of the world around us, and also in personal forms. And this is what human beings have done with deities throughout time. You know, modernist thinkers claim that to seek the grace of a deity is just the way human beings have found to exercise some measure of control or some sense of control in a world that often seems to be totally out of control. The modern scientific worldview essentially believes that deities are superstitious ideas that are certainly unnecessary since the world runs itself on natural laws. And yet my personal experience and that of generations of lovers of deity forms is quite different. My experience, and I think the experience of many of you, is that when we invoke and call on these subtle figures that we personify as goddesses or as gods or as god or goddess, it doesn't only enhance our sense of protection and control, it deepens our connection to our own powers. Deity practice, in my experience, makes us more accessible to the love that is always waiting within us to express itself. Deity practice can cure our sense of being alone in the universe. And if we do it with a fundamentally non-dual practice perspective, it will eventually reanimate the world. It will literally bring back the enchantment in the world. It will change our perspective so that we can start to experience, as we've been saying, the sacredness in our own bodies. And even in the situations in life that we really, really have problems integrating. So it's traditional to begin any study of the Indian goddess tradition by invoking the goddess Durga, as we have been doing. And there are two reasons that I'm particularly drawn to talking about Durga tonight. Actually, there are three reasons. One is that I have a very deep personal connection with Durga, because the name that my guru gave me when he initiated me in as a swami was Durga Ananda, which means the bliss of Goddess Durga. And, you know, there's, but the two things I wanted to say is that first, Durga is a goddess of victory. She's the goddess who many kings in India invoked for victory in battle. She's also the goddess of justice. She's the goddess who protects the underdog. She's the form of the Divine Mother you can call on when things are really, really bad, knowing that she'll come to your rescue. She's also, at least in my own experience, the energy behind all the different movements for social justice, including the feminist movement, the movements for racial justice, for all the ways in which we have in modern times begun to look into and make reparations for, at least within ourselves, for the injustices that have historically been part of this universe. And in other words, she's a goddess whose gift we need badly, particularly at this moment in time. So even though we anchor ourselves in non-duality, even though in our understanding about goddess, we do really realize that she's the context in which life happens, and that from a non-dual perspective, justice and injustice are just polarities, and goddess herself encompasses all of this. As long as we are in Maya, as long as we are enveloped by the sense of separation, we're going to be experiencing duality. We're going to experience ourselves as in here and other people as out there. And that duality of me and God, me and you, self and other, leads to all the other dualities, darkness and light, good and bad, kindness and cruelty, hope and despair. So issues of justice and injustice, of good and evil, of right action and wrong action, which are all part of the relative world, are very serious issues in the life of this world, and they are aspects of this world that every one of us has to deal with daily, day by day. So I'd like to speak about Durga, who I call the goddess of social justice, among her many other qualities. We'll do it inside the overall context of recognizing her as the source that holds justice and injustice, the paradox in which goddess is concealed both in what we call evil and in what we call good. This is fundamental tantric viewpoint. And yet, at the same time, to realize that the goddess Durga in her historical role in myth is the force of the divine feminine who comes to the rescue of those who are in trouble, of those who are powerless, and of those who are being oppressed. So I just want to say that for me, and for many people of my generation, which was the 70s generation, I came into spiritual life out of a tremendous despair about my power to affect change in the world. And I came into spiritual life at a time which many people are noting is very, very similar to what's happening now. So in other words, I had watched the idealistic political movements of the 60s and 70s fall apart, lose their idealism and momentum, get taken over by various, you know, power grabbers, if you will, failed in various ways, although they certainly succeeded in others. But I also had seen that my sense of injustice, my personal sense of injustice, was fueled by many agendas, including my personal anger, my personal feelings of victimization, and by the kind of inflation that happens when we have a beautiful social vision. I had understood that it's very hard to know what effective action really is. And like many people, and many of you here, I had decided that rather than trying to change things on the outside, I would start by trying to change myself, to try and work on my own anger, my own greediness, my own cruelty. And when I came back to the forms of social activism that I now engage in, I did it from a place of real extreme humility. In other words, I had come to realize that my own actions, even though they can be amplified by other human beings, but that they are also powerless without radical divine help, without some kind of help from the forces that invisibly govern the world. And so I had come to see that the divine power that I needed to enlist for active justice had to be activated inside and outside. So, in other words, I was coming to see that it was possible to ask for help from a divine power that's seen as external in the good old traditional religious way. But at the same time, because of the practice that I had done and the practice that you've done, I could also understand that by calling on the protective powers of the sacred as a helpful force from, let's say, above, I could simultaneously call upon those forces inside. So part of what we're going to look at is, and what we're especially in the course of the week, is how we experience calling on Goddess for help and how we experience incarnating this particular form of the Goddess. How we can both surrender to her and also to confidently allow her to act through us and as us. So let's again come back to the breath. See if you can tune into the prana shakti flowing towards you, into you, through you. Not only through your nostrils, but through the pores of your body. See if you can allow yourself to sense into the fact that Goddess is breathing you. And you can inhale with the thought, Aum Dum Durgaya Namaha. And then exhale with the thought, Aum Dum Durgaya Namaha. See if you can allow these mantras, which are actually filled with the power to bring this form of the Goddess alive in us. See if you can sense these mantras as a kind of vibratory energy that you might experience as a throb in the breath, or that you might experience as energies that very subtly impact your inner body, perhaps your heart. Om Dum Durgaya Namaha. For those of you who can feel into your heartbeat, and you might even place your hand over the center of your chest or over your heart and sense the heartbeat through the hands, you might even listen to Om Dum Durgaya Namaha as the throb of your heart, as though your heart is beating this invocation to the Goddess, Om Dum Durgaya Namaha, Om Dum Durgaya Namaha, Om Dum Durgaya Namaha. We're going to enter into this next section of our class tonight by looking at what is probably the most significant and important goddess myth in the Indian tradition. It comes from a text called the Devi Mahatmyam, which literally means the great triumph of the Devi, the goddess. The name Devi, D-E-V-I, the E is pronounced like A, is the feminine form that is a feminine form that means shining one, and there's a masculine form, Deva, as well. The text of the Devi Mahatmyam consists of 700 verses, most of which describe three stories about the three major appearances of goddess Durga, who also has many, many names. She has hundreds of names. She's called Chandika, which means the impetuous, fierce one, Ambika, the lotus-eyed one, Aparajita, the unconquerable one, Katyayani, which means the maiden. She has many, many other names, and in all these moments, she enters the world to intervene on behalf of the good, of the light. So this particular form of goddess is really, I guess, the original light worker in this tradition. And I want to speak about her today in the context of what some of my old friends call the good fight. In fact, it's now a TV series with Christine Baranski and quite a few other actresses and even some actors. It's about fighting for social justice as a lawyer in Chicago. And it really is about a group of women who are doing their very best to incarnate goddess Durga. So Durga is the warrior feminine par excellence. She embodies the power of what some Jungians call the yang feminine, the dynamic, active aspect of the feminine, that impulse that bursts up from within the heart for action. There are other goddesses who we could call yin feminine goddesses, that is, their manifestation is as a nurturer, as a, you know, a kind of a vast womb that holds experience as presence, as the great black light of peace that contains all paradoxes and contradictions. Many of the black Madonnas of Europe or the figure of Mary in Christian mythology are examples of the yin feminine, though they are also activists in their own way. Goddess Durga carries an array of weapons. She has a sword, she has a spear, she has a bow and arrows, she has a club, she has a trident. She carries on one finger a discus, which is an ancient weapon, which a little bit like a fidget spinner, except that it has sharp swords on all of its spokes and can essentially slice off a head if it meets you, if it meets your neck. So Durga is Wonder Woman meets Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She's utterly, incredibly kick-ass. And I think many people who saw the movie Wonder Woman got a sense of what Durga feels like, what the felt sense of Durga is like in the very early scenes in the movie where we see a group of warrior women, including the heroine, in their natural habitat. It really felt to me watching that movie as though goddess Durga had kind of come alive on the screen. She's a goddess we call on for help in every battle we have to fight, and whom we are meant to incarnate in our activist aspects as women. Men have their own activist masculine deities to incarnate. Durga, I would say, is the feminine figure whom we bring into ourselves to fully activate our capacity to be warriors as in female bodies. So when I think of Durga, I often think of the radical activist women that I've known, the women who act out of a powerful inner necessity to redress the imbalances in the world. Very often, actually, these women act in concert with a male counterpart, with a consort or a partner. But there's a couple of things I want to say about the true Durga female. She acts out of necessity. She acts because there's nobody else to do it, because she's been guided to the task that's hers. Secondly, she doesn't give up. She's absolutely relentless. Third, she knows when to stop. And fourth, she acts without ego, from a sense of deep connection to the universe. My favorite human example of the power of the Durga force is a friend of mine who, her name is Ruth. She's a psychotherapist by nature, but she was living in Los Angeles, and she noticed that every month crop dusters would fly over her West LA neighborhood, emitting clouds of herbicide, which was supposed to keep, I guess, mosquitoes out of the area and, you know, the creatures that infect crops. And she also noticed that every time the planes went over, her son would have an asthma attack. So she investigated. She got some other mothers in the neighborhood together. And through over a period of years, she discovered the chemical composition of what was in those planes. It was a incredibly deadly gas. She had the crop sprayings discontinued. And she did this all calmly and unflinchingly because she knew that something was wrong and she believed she had the power to stop it. So I think every one of us has had an experience, whether in our personal life or in public life, when we've felt this power of the sacred activist goddess. And it's not that we're always able to maintain that egoless state. You know, we often, when we're very active, especially when we're active in pursuit of justice, we're not saintly and calm. We get angry. We feel despair. We act unskillfully. We make mistakes. And yet, as we practice with remembrance of the goddess, we start to see that she's there upholding every action that intends to restore the balance of the world, whether it's the balance we need to restore in our own inner world and our own lives, or the balance of the external world. And there'll be times, because this is part of what Durga does, when she'll lop off one of the heads of your ego, because for most of us, the deep scars of ego don't let go without a struggle. But in fact, she's always telling us, and this is part of the inner let's say the inner wisdom that we get when we begin to invoke Goddess Durga. She's always showing us that when we act out of ego, even when we feel we're acting for the good, there will in some sense be negative consequences. And yet she also shows us that we nonetheless have to go on. We nonetheless have to act as we are, with the best will in the world, and constantly offer our actions up to her in what to me is perhaps the biggest takeaway of goddess practice, which is to constantly offer what we do, what we say, what we think into her hands. So the poem of the Devi Mahatmayam is a hero story embedded in a radically non-dual teaching, which tells us that what we experience as a personal journey is part of the wholeness that both supports, transcends us, and acts through us. Goddess teachings are always giving us that message. So in this recognition, our lives are both unique, specific, and also transparent to the power of being, which acts through us. So in a certain sense, each of us are engaged in our own hero narrative. We're all acting out of the Durga. We're all acting out our own version of the Durga myth as we strive to self-actualize, to liberate ourselves, to act compassionately and skillfully in order to make both the inner world and the world around us better. So at the level of sadhana, at the level of spiritual growth, the Devi Mahatmyam is about what she's willing to do to liberate us from our ignorance, from our blindness. And on the external level, it's about how, though the arc of history is long, it ultimately bends towards justice. So in the Devi Mahatmyam, there is one invocation that's repeated again and again, and it goes, Om Namas Chandikaye, Om, the primordial sound, Namas, which means I honor or I bow to, and Chandikaye, the fierce goddess, the goddess whose name means the violent and impetuous one, whose fierceness inspires awe, whose fierceness is the ecstatic urgency of the evolutionary force, which is going to radically dissolve our blindness so that the world can evolve, so that the ultimate good of self-recognition through all the forms of the world can be accomplished. So in this form, she's also known as Mahakali, the great dark one, and she represents the divine will to brush aside all obstructions on the path. There's a, in one of my favorite books on the goddess, which is Aurobindo's little book, The Mother, he describes his form of the goddess as the revolutionary capacity which can accomplish in a moment what would otherwise take years. So without her, the demonic forces would destroy everything. And yet, she also represents Mahamaya, the force which contains all that is and which hides from us the oneness. So this is her paradox. So these are the words. These are the words of one of the hymns in the Devi Mahatmyam. Salutations to the goddess, to the great goddess. Salutations to her who is auspicious. Salutations to her who is terrible. Salutations to the primal cause, to her who is gracious, to the eternal shining one, to her who sustains the universe. Salutations again and again. Salutations to her who is prosperity and attainment, who is the good fortune and bad fortune of us all. Salutations to Durga, who takes us through difficulties, who is the creator and indwelling essence of all, who is right knowledge. We bow down to her who is most gentle and most fierce. We bow down to the goddess who is creative action. Salutations again and again. The core message of the Devi Mahatmyam is that the goddess saves. She intervenes. She comes to the aid of the world. And the story, the myth, offers us three cycles in what it sees as the eternal conflict between the light and dark forces. One of the underlying assumptions of the tantric worldview is that everything is cyclical. That was the invisible sound of the goddess's bell, by the way. It's one of her implements. She carries a bell. And that one meant wake up in case you've fallen into a dream state. So in the goddess tradition and in many of the ancient traditions, there is this basic understanding that everything is cyclical, that there are endless cycles of time, that time is a long game, and that in order to act skillfully within that long game, we also need to have the long view, even as we act within the short view. So the text gives us these three stories that tell us something about the way the force of grace works at different stages. The Platonic philosopher Synesius of Cyrene said, "Myths are things that never happened, but always are." I love that. Myths are things that never happened, but always are. So myths, as Joseph Campbell famously said, express truths about the world that can only be told as stories. They're not literally true. but they are they're true in they're emotionally true, they're spiritually true. They are true in the deepest sense. So the reason that it's a cycle, by the way, is because when the old dark forces are slain, new and subtler dark forces arise, because the on the level of the world, the struggle between light and dark, between what we call good and what we call evil, between those who seek personal power for the sake of self-aggrandizement and those who seek power for the good of the whole, that struggle is always going on. It's always taking new forms. And we're always being called on to do our own sacred fixing with the grace of Durga. The Hebrew word tikkun describes this. Every one of us is called upon at different times to do our own fixing. And the irony here is that though we must commit to doing the fixing, whether it's the fixing of the, you know, the suffering within our maternal or paternal lineages, or the fixing of our own misunderstandings, or the fixing of a situation in our town, we can't do it ourselves. We require divine help for that. And that what I've discovered over the years is that the impetus to seek the help of Goddess comes out of a sense of personal failure. In other words, I began asking for help in those moments when I realized that my own personal powers were not enough to bring about the task that I wanted. So I think that one of the gifts of human life is that in some sense failure is built into us, and that when we fail, we very often are drawn to cry out, drawn to call out, drawn to recognize our own profound vulnerability and allow the force that protects us even in the midst of vulnerability to emerge and make a difference. So at the heart of all these stories is this terrible, precarious moment when the balance is upset, when it looks as though the dark forces will triumph. And at the heart of it is the decision to ask for help. So the goddess's cycle is in the form of a story that's told by a sage to two guys named Surata and Samadhi. Surata is a king who's been defeated by his enemies, thrown out of his kingdom. Samadhi is a merchant whose greedy family has cheated him and also cast him out. So both men are desperate. They want to get back their land, their family, their possessions. And they're also spiritual seekers, so they're kind of embarrassed to be so driven by their attachments. And they come to the hermitage of the sage asking for advice. And he tells them the story of the goddess as a way of showing them the deeper truth about the world. And he says, all beings have awareness. Birds and animals have it. Yet all these beings, including humans, are hurled into the whirlpool of attachment and delusion by Mahamaya, the great enchantress. She creates this universe, and it is she who graciously bestows liberation on human beings. This is a very important point that we'll get into later. So the merchant and the king ask, where did she come from? How did she emerge? The sage says, she's eternal. She has the form of the world. She pervades all this. Therefore, we don't normally see her. However, at certain moments, she's born into the world to right wrongs. And he begins to tell the story of the Devi Mahatmaya. It starts back before the worlds existed. And this story goes, if you've read Indian scriptures, you may even know this story, that Vishnu, the great masculine sustainer of the universe, who is in the Indian text, he's also the activist love warrior of the universe. Vishnu is lying asleep on the ocean of consciousness. In the beautiful mythology of the Vishnu's tradition, the universe is seen as Vishnu's dream, which literally appears in his divine mind. And Brahma, the male deity who's tasked with creating the physical world, emerges from Vishnu's navel. And Brahma's cosmic job is to manifest a physical universe. But at the same time that Brahma appears, two demons, they have names, they're called Nadu and Kaitaba, they burst forth from Vishnu's ears. Apparently they've been hiding in his earwax, which might be an indication that we should clean our ears. The idea that our ears could be stopped up by the forces of ignorance is a really interesting one. You know, what is it that keeps us from hearing the truth or that distorts the truth for us? So these are very primitive negative forces, Madhu and Kaitava. They're the energies that grow in unconscious behavior. And they grab Brahma, trying to kill him, and Vishnu is still asleep. So Brahma does what we all are asked to do at moments like this. He calls on the goddess. He sings this very, very famous hymn, calling out the imperishable eternal one, the great knowledge and liberation, the great intelligence, the radiant splendor of the universe. And he describes her, you know, he flatters her. You armed with sword and spear, club and discus, you inspire dread, yet you are pleasing, you're more pleasing than everyone else, and exceedingly beautiful. So as he prays to the goddess, he asks, may Vishnu be awakened and roused to slay these demons. And as he's watching, a black smoke emerges from Vishnu's eyes, from his mouth, from his heart, from his arms, literally releasing Vishnu from the magical sleep. The black smoke, the text explains, is the goddess's power of delusion and ignorance. And this is the most important line, which only she can remove. This is very significant. You can't remove your primal ignorance. She needs to do it. So in this myth, we see that in the Maya of ignorance, which is part of the inexplicable mystery of goddess, we become unconscious, we become asleep, both to the suffering of the world and to its joy. And, you know, there's an entire tradition in, for instance, in Beowulf is a very good example of it, where a male hero fights a female earth power. In Beowulf, it's Grendel's mother, Grendel being the monster who's enslaving the world, and his mother being the kind of embedded power behind him. And, you know, it's often said in the psychological tales of the transformations that occurred as human consciousness began to individuate, is that that this moment when the male hero slays the feminine monster is the moment when human consciousness evolves out of its primitive embeddedness in sentient. However, the story tells it differently, because here goddess is the source of the darkness as well as the source of the light. The darkness is her Maya, the veil that she creates in order that individuals will not realize their true powers, will not recognize her presence as the world, will veil us through, you know, what we now call the default mode network, which is the processes in our brain which make us see the world as outside us. So in that darkness, in this first story, nothing can evolve. So what's kind of remarkable about this story is that it's an illustration of the power of Shakti, because Vishnu, after all, is Godhead. I mean, he's the personal form of deity. Vishnu is probably the primordial, the most popular form in which God is known and worshipped in Indian spirituality. And Vishnu, actually, at least in my experience of this particular form of deity, Vishnu is the energy of Vishnu is very close to Christ energy. It's a very, very loving and very powerfully activist energy. But the point is that the goddess's Maya is so strong that it blinds even God. And it also points out that the darkness is her form. She's the darkness as well as the light. I keep saying this because it's an idea that is very central to goddess, to the understanding of the Shakta viewpoint. The point being that it's all ultimately under her control. So, and what this story says, among other things, is that in order to inspire goddess to remove the veil, we need to deeply want her to do it. In other words, it's Brahma's prayers, not Vishnu's, he's asleep. It's Brahma's prayers that inspire goddess to remove the darkness from him. So this is the first part of the cycle. And traditionally in India, these verses are recited during the first 3 days of a 9-day goddess festival, and the purpose of this story and the prayers in it and the transformation that occurs when we bring forth this aspect of the goddess is that we experience a radical purification of some of the forms, the very deep forms of ignorance, that is sleepiness, ignorance, slothfulness, despair, the qualities that in Indian tradition are called tamasic, the qualities that keep us inert and bound. So just as the Chandika removes the sleep from Vishnu's body, when we invoke her with God, with mantras, she will remove through our practice the different forms of radical inertia and blindness that keep us from actively seeking our destiny. So let's again bring our awareness to the breath. Inhaling with Om Dun Durgaye Namaha. Exhaling with Om Dun Durgaye Namaha. Imagine that with the exhalation, subtle forms of delusion, of slothfulness, of sleepiness, many of the forms of unconsciousness that may have gathered in your subtle being, let's say over the course of the day and the week and the month and the year, have the feeling that as you exhale with the mantras of Durga, Om Dum Durgaye Namaha, you're breathing out the darkness that's stuck in your subtle body. And feel that these dark energies are flowing out in the form of smoke, as though the mantras are simply pulling up forms of ignorance, the residue of negative thinking, some of the deep traumatic imprints of your life. She's pulling up some of these forms of darkness from your cells, and they're being released with every exhalation through the power of the mantra Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. The second story in the Durga cycle of the Devi Mahatmayam is actually the most famous story in the cycle. It's the you'll find it in innumerable paintings of the goddess Durga, carved in sculptures in Mahabalipuram, which is one of the kind of amazing sites of sacred art in South India. It appears in the walls of temples. And this is the famous battle between the goddess Durga and the buffalo demon, who's called Mahishasura. Mahishasura literally means buffalo demon. And Mahishasura represents the ego in its most expansive form. He's a buffalo, so he's kind of a primitive character. But he represents the drug lords, the warlords, the dictators, the primitive powers that, since the beginning of human civilization, have tried to control others in the name of a single family or tribe under the principle of might makes right. And, of course, this is something that we are very conscious of. The presence of such beings in the world is very much in the news these days. And to understand the meaning of the battle and of who Mahishasura was, it's actually helpful to get an understanding of what asuras were in Indian cosmology. So in the tradition of India, the devas, the gods, who are also called suras, represented the forces of harmony and order in the universe, and they were extremely successful. They were, you know, they lived in good neighborhoods, probably still do. They live in light realms. Their job, really, their cosmic function is to make sure that the elements of the world are in order. So, for instance, the devas are the personal forms of the sun, of the moon, of the thunder. They have names like Indra, who's the thunder deity, and the head god, Surya, who's the deity of the sun, Varuna, who is the personal form of water and of rain, Prithvi, who's the earth goddess, Agni, the lord of fire. These are deities, elemental deities, and they were seen as the controllers of the natural forces. Their aim is to keep the world in harmony, to keep the world functioning in a way that's that does good to everybody. So, and the whole of the Indian Vedic tradition was based on, as in many ancient traditions, making offerings to these elemental deities, so that the world that they lived in would work well, would be harmonious. The asuras are their natural enemies. The asuras are, as one of my teacher friends says, they have different value systems than the gods. They're all about getting what they can for themselves. So they are the forces of corruption, of power games, of rage, of lust, who attempt constantly to overthrow the natural order in order to gain all the wealth and all the good of the world for themselves. So their mantras are might makes right and me first, and they're single-minded and very, very powerful because they have no scruples. They'll do anything. So, and Mahishasura is also represents our primitive strength and rage. You know, one of the famous warlords of the 20th century, Idi Amin, was the subject of a movie called The Last King of Scotland, which actually describes what an asura is like in real time. And, you know, we know them all. We see them in Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad and Papa Doc Duvalier and certain people in our own country. And in the early stages of the reign of darkness, which often happens in the so-called real world, they conquer everyone. They throw the gods out of heaven. They enslave the humans. And the gods are powerless. They are completely vulnerable. Nothing they do works. They've been defeated over and over again. So finally, the gods approach Vishnu and Shiva to complain and ask for help. And as they're petitioning, the story goes, a light, a radiance starts to emerge from within Vishnu's face. It's the crystallized radiance of his power, his Shakti. You know, in the Indian tradition, the powers of the deities, of the great deities, are called their Shaktis. It's, that is to say, that the feminine, the Shakti, is what empowers the masculine deity forms. So that divine feminine form, who is the form of Mahalakshmi, who is Vishnu's consort, is his crystallized radiance, his crystallized power. And at that moment, light emerges from all the different gods. So Surya's light, which is the light of the power of the shining sun, the power that Shiva's power, Varuna's power, all the gods that offer up their innate radiance, their innate Shakti, and it coalesces into a mountain of radiance, which gradually takes the form of the goddess. So that form literally pervades the world with its light. It spreads out over the world, and for a moment, the gods see their powers incarnate as a divine woman. And the poem explains how each aspect of her Shakti that has been held inside the bodies of different gods come together to form her face, her hair, her arms. It's not that the gods create her, and it's not that they lose power when their radiance comes into her. The hymn explains this. It's that because she is all powers, she can, the gods can hold their power, and yet it can take the form of this goddess, who is the, let's call it, crystallized form of the all-pervading Shakti. So, and the verse says, dawn and dusk became her eyebrows. Shiva's Shakti formed her face. Vishnu's effulgence became her arms. The moon god's soft radiance became her breasts. And each of the deities offers their own weapons to her, swords, spears, spinning discuses, as well as jewels and garlands and beautiful robes. The god of mountains offers her a lion for her mount. The sun god offers rays of sunlight that flow from every pore of her skin. And as she reveals herself, she gives a great laugh, which comes out like a roar, like a thunderous roar. The power of Shakti fully unleashed, no longer concealed within the crevices of the physical world. It's as if the true power that upholds the world has revealed itself. So everything shakes, the oceans turn, earthquakes shake the ground, Mount Kilauea erupts, the mountains heave, and the goddess laughs and laughs and laughs, and the gods roar with joy, crying out, Jai, meaning victory, Jai, Jai Ma, Jai Ma. And when the demon Mahishasura hears this, which he can't help but do, he begins to bellow in rage. And with his armies, he rushes towards the sound, and there he sees this vast female radiance literally pervading all directions, bending the earth under her feet. Such a great image, scraping the sky with her crown. Sort of like the image of the cosmic form, if you remember the Bhagavad Gita, penetrating every direction with her thousand arms. And the battle is a celestial Armageddon. Billions of demons, literally billions of demons, attack her from all sides. And they have names. They have great names. One is called the Yak-Headed. The other is called Sword-Haired. Another has the name Negative Depressed Thoughts. Another is called the Fetid One because he stinks. And they represent the powers of negativity. So, and as the goddess fights them off, Her face is completely serene. Each of her sighs, each sound she makes is like a mantra that brings forth from the into the battlefield millions of legions of celestial warriors. So, and there's no effort to any of this. She's simply expressing the natural flow of her incarnate power, much as the power of nature acts without effort, without ego or identification. Much as, you know, as you may have read, the local people who live on the big island of Hawaii, the Hawaiians, the native Hawaiians, many of whom are devotees of the goddess Pele, who is seen as the creatrix of the Hawaiian archipelago and who lives in its volcanoes. They say that the eruption of Kilauea volcano is the goddess's response to the years of geothermal insertions that have been done in the volcano against the protests of the native people, in which the U.S. government has been trying to take heat and power from the volcano and has created all these fissures in the side of the mountain. So, you know, the volcano is now erupting pretty much once a week and spreading lava all over that part of the Big Island. Sort of similar to what's going on in this battle in a certain way. So finally, after, you know, these millions of demons have been destroyed, Mahishasura, in the form of an enormous buffalo, sweeps aside the goddess's hosts. He grows as huge as the mountains, as big as she is, lashing the ocean into storms, blasting the mountains into smithereens with his breath. He's really powerful, and he's totally enraged. And we could say, you know, from one point of view, that the, if we're looking for a definition of evil, we might say that it's here in the demon's reaction to the beauty and grace of the Devi. Why would anyone want to destroy that incomparable beauty? You know, it's the same question as to why someone would want to destroy a human life or the beauty of ancient civilizations or tear up a meadow to build a parking lot. It's the rage and destructive powers of the forces of egoic consciousness. And the goddess, remember, totally calm, she throws a lasso over him, ties him up, and when she does, he begins shape-changing. He becomes a lion. He becomes a human male with a sword. He becomes an elephant. And these are all the different disguises of ego, representing all the ways in which ego takes forms as something other than what it is. But by lassoing him and then finally pinning him down with a spear, she forces him to come back into his original form. His form is a buffalo. And then there's this famous moment. The goddess manifests a goblet full of divine liquor and knocks it back, laughing with, you know, intoxication, as the demon literally hurls mountains at her. She says, "Roar, you fool, while I drink this potion." And then she pins him down with her foot. You can see it in the paintings, pierces him with her spear, literally putting the ego in its place. And as he dies, that is, with the death of the ego, his true form emerges from the mouth of the buffalo. And the poem doesn't say what his true form looks like, but the implication is that this is his soul, that the deep purity of the light of his soul, which she has freed by destroying his ego and his body. So when he dies, he merges into the goddess. He becomes part of her great body. So this moment, when the goddess destroys the ego after a mighty battle, which in many of our lives is, you know, a real thing many of us experience a lot of blows from life as we pass through this process of learning how to surrender to the true desire of our soul, which really is to incarnate the light. That this battle, the battle of Durga with Mahishasura, is fought again and again and again in our souls, in the world, and the outcome of it, which is crucially significant to all that we understand about the goddess empowerment. The outcome of it is the liberation of our soul from all the disguises with which it's identified. So all these stories, all these myths of the goddess are really myths about our own freedom. And as I consider the stories of Durga and the opportunity that the warrior goddess offers us, it really is to trust the soul, which holds within itself all of these divine powers, which we will discuss in detail as the weeks go on. And to really learn that in that moment, when goddess, with complete serenity and calm, skewers the body of this destructive force which has enslaved the universe, she frees not only that one soul, she frees countless souls from ignorance. So, as we conclude this evening, we'll return to the breath, and we'll sit together for a few moments, allowing ourselves to be breathed by the force of goddess that flows through the universe, allowing the breath to flow in as though through every pore of our body, and allowing the breath to flow with the exhalation with the thought, Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. As this mantra subtly clears obstructions, forms of ignorance, suffering from our physical and subtle bodies, we'll allow ourselves to surrender to the breath and invoke goddess through her mantras. Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. If you can spend a few minutes after we close sitting with the breath and the mantra, that would be really good. The goddess, the sacred feminine, is the power of life, manifesting as love in all its forms. Protective love, warrior love, erotic love, motherly love, fierce love, wisdom, protection. Every form of wisdom and knowledge. Just in this moment, as we close the call, recognize that the prana which flows into your body with the inhalation flows as light. She is breathing light into you. And as you recognize that light with the words of the mantra, Om Dum Durgaye Namaha, you feel that light flowing through your pores and out into your world. as your radiance expands and touches the air, the furniture in the room, the earth beneath your feet. Have a beautiful evening or day. The MP3, for those of you who are live on the call, will be available tomorrow. The homework will come to you in the morning. I'm so happy to be with you all. Thank you so much. Om Dum Durgaye Namaha. Namaste. Namaste.